It took them 2 days, and by the time they reached the top, a mile or so back from the brink of the escarpment, they were exhausted.
"I feel as if somebody's been beating on me with a stick," Barak groaned, sinking to the ground in the brushy gully at the top of the cut. "A very big, dirty stick."
They all sat on the ground among the prickly thorn bushes, recovering from the dreadful climb.
"I'll have a look around," Silk said after only a few moments.
The small man had the body of an acrobat, supple and strong, quick to restore itself. He crept up to the rim of the gully, ducking low under the thorn bushes and worming his way the last few feet on his stomach to peer carefully over the top. After several minutes, he gave a low whistle, and they saw him motion sharply for them to join him.
Barak groaned again and stood up. Durnik, Mandorallan, and Geryon also got stiffly to their feet. "See what he wants," Bulgareth told them. "I am not ready to start moving around just yet."
The four of them started up the slope through the loose gravel toward the spot where Silk lay, peering out from under a thorn bush, crawling the last few feet as he had done.
"What's the trouble?"
Barak asked the little man as they came up beside him.
"Company,"
Silk replied shortly, pointing out over the rocky, arid plain, lying brown and dead under the flat gray sky. A cloud of yellow dust, whipped low to the ground by the stiff, chill wind, gave evidence of riders.
"I patrol?"
Durnik asked in a hushed voice.
"I don't think so," Silk answered. "Toes are not comfortable on horses. They usually patrol on foot."
Geryon peered out across that arid waste.
"Is that somebody out in front of them?"
he asked, pointing at a tiny moving speck, a half mile or so in front of the riders.
"Ah,"
Silk said, with a peculiar kind of sadness.
"What is it?"
Barak asked.
"Don't keep secrets, Silk. I'm just not in the mood for it."
"They are Grolems," Silk explained. "The one they are chasing is a Tull, trying to escape being sacrificed. It happens rather frequently."
"Should Belgarath be warned?"
Mandorallan suggested.
"It is probably not necessary," Silk replied. "The Grolems around here are mostly low-ranking. I doubt that any of them would have any skill at sorcery."
"I'll go check him anyway,"
Durnik said. He slid back away from the edge of the gully, rose, and went back down to where the old man rested with Aunt Paul and Relg.
"As long as we stay out of sight, we'll probably be all right," Silk told them. "It looks as if there are only three of them, and they are concentrating on the Tull."
The running man had moved closer. He ran with his head down and his arms pumping at his sides.
"What happens if he tries to hide here in the gully?"
Barak asked. Silk shrugged.
"The Grolems will follow him."
"We would have to take steps at that point, wouldn't we?"
Silk nodded with a wicked little smirk.
"We could call him, I suppose," Barak suggested, loosening his sword in its sheath.
"The same thought had just occurred to me."
Durnik came back up the slope, his feet crunching in the gravel.
"Wolf says to keep an eye on them," he reported. "But he says not to do anything unless they actually start into the gully."
"Oh, what a shame,"
Silk sighed regretfully. The running Tull was clearly visible now. He was a thick-bodied man in a rough tunic, belted at the waist. His hair was shaggy and mud-colored. His face was contorted into an expression of brutish panic. He passed the place where they hid, perhaps 30 paces out on the flats, and Geryon could clearly hear his breath whistling in his throat as he pounded past. He was whimpering as he ran, an animal-like sound of absolute despair.
"They almost never try to hide,"
Silk said in a soft voice tinged with pity.
"All they do is run."
He shook his head.
They'll overtake him soon,
Mandarallan observed. The pursuing Grolems wore black hooded robes and polished steel masks.
We had better get down,
Barak advised them. They all ducked below the gully rim. A few minutes later, the three horses galloped by, their hooves thudding on the hard earth.
Well, they'll catch him in a few more minutes,
Geryon said.
He's running right for the edge. He'll be trapped.
I don't think so, Silk replied somberly. A moment later, they heard a long, despairing shriek, fading horribly into the gulf below.
I more or less expected that, Silk said.
Geryon's stomach wrenched at the thought of the dreadful height of the escarpment.
They're coming back, Barak warned. Get down.
The three Grolems rode back along the edge of the gully. One of them said something Geryon could not quite hear, and the other two laughed.
The world might be a better place with three less Grolems in it,
Mandarallan suggested in a grim whisper.
Attractive thought, Silk agreed. But Belgarath would probably disapprove. I suppose it's better to let them go. We would not want anyone looking for them.
Barak looked longingly after the three Grolems, then sighed with deep regret.
Let's go back down, Silk said.
They all turned and crawled back down to the brushy gully. Belgarath looked up as they returned.
Are they gone?
They are riding off, Silk told him.
What was that cry? Relg asked.
Three Grolems chased Aethul off the edge of the escarpment, Silk replied.
Why?
He had been selected for a certain religious observance, and he did not want to participate.
He refused.
Relg sounded shocked.
He deserved his fate, then.
I don't think that you appreciate the nature of Grolem ceremonies, Relg.
One must submit to the will of one's god,
Relg insisted. There was a sanctimonious note to his voice.
Religious obligations are absolute.
Silk's eyes glittered as he looked at the Olgo fanatic.
How much do you know about the Angarak religion, Relg?
I concern myself only with the religion of Ulgo.
A man ought to know what he is talking about before he makes any judgments.
Let it lie, Silk, Aunt Paul told him.
I don't think so, Pogra. Not this time. A few facts might be good for our devout friend here. He seems to lack perspective.
Silk turned back to Relg.
The core of the Angarak religion is a ritual most men find repugnant. Tolls devote their entire lives to avoiding it. That's the central reality of Tullish life.
An abominable people.
Relg's denunciation was harsh.
No. Tulls are stupid, even brutish. But they are hardly abominable. You see, Relg, the ritual we are talking about involves human sacrifice.
Relg pulled the veil from his eyes to stare incredulously at the rat-faced little man.
Each year, 2,000 tolls are sacrificed to Torak,
Silk went on, his eyes boring into Relg's stunned face.
The Grolems permit the substitution of slaves, so Aethul spends his whole life working in order to get enough money to buy a slave to take his place on the altar if he is unlucky enough to be chosen. But slaves die sometimes, or they escape. If Aethul without a slave is chosen, he usually tries to run. Then the Grolems chase him. They have had a lot of practice, so they are very good at it. I have never heard of us all actually getting away.
It is their duty to submit,
Relg maintained stubbornly, though he seemed a bit less sure of himself.
How are they sacrificed?
Dernick asked in a subdued voice. The Tho's willingness to hurl himself off of the escarpment had obviously shaken him.
"It is a simple procedure," Silk replied, watching Relg closely. "Two Grolems bend the toll backward over the altar, and a third cuts out his heart. Then they burn the heart in a little fire. Torak is not interested in the whole toll. He only wants the heart."
Relg flinched at that. "Oh, they sacrifice women, too," Silg pressed.
"But women have a simpler means of escape. The Grolem will not sacrifice a pregnant woman. It confuses their count. So Tholish women try to stay pregnant constantly. That explains why there are so many Tholls, and why Tholish women are notorious for their indiscriminate appetite."
"Monstrous," Relg gasped. "Death would be better than such a vile corruption."
"Death lasts a very long time, Relg." Silk said it with a cold little smile. "A little corruption can be forgotten rather quickly if you put your mind to it. That is particularly true if your life depends on it."
Relg's face was troubled as he struggled with the blunt description of the horror of Tullish life.
"You're a wicked man," he accused Silk, though the voice lacked conviction.
"Yes, I know," Silk admitted.
Relg appealed to Belgarath.
"Is what he says true?"
The sorcerer scratched thoughtfully at his beard.
"He doesn't seem to have left out very much," he replied. "The word religion means different things to different people, Relg. It depends on the nature of one's god. You ought to try to get that sorted out in your mind. It might make some of the things that you will have to do a bit easier."
"I think that we have just about exhausted the possibilities of this conversation, Father," Aunt Paul suggested, "and we have a very long way to go."
"Right," he agreed, getting to his feet.
They rode down through the arid jumble of rock and scrubby bushes that spread across the western frontier of the Land of the Tholls. The continual wind that swept up across the escarpment was bitterly cold, though there were only a few patches of thin snow lying beneath the somber gray sky. Relg's eyes adjusted to the subdued light, and the clouds appeared to quiet the panic the open sky had caused him. But this was obviously a difficult time for him. The world here above ground was alien, and everything he encountered seemed to shatter his preconceptions. It was also a time of personal religious turmoil, and the crisis goaded him into peculiar fluctuations of speech and action. At one moment he would sanctimoniously denounce the sinful wickedness of others, his face set in a stern expression of righteousness. And in the next, he would be writhing in an agony of self-loathing, confessing his sin and guilt in an endless, repetitious litany to any who would listen. His pale face and huge dark eyes, framed by the hood of his leaf-mail shirt, contorted in the tumult of his emotions. Once again the others, even, patient, good-hearted Dernick, drew away from him, leaving him entirely to Geryon. Relg stopped often for prayers and obscure little rituals that always seemed to involve a great deal of groveling in the dirt.
"It's going to take us all a year to get to Rachtal in this rate," Barak rumbled sourly on one such occasion, glaring with open dislike at the ranting fanatic kneeling in the sand beside the trail. "We need him," Belgarath replied calmly. "And he needs this. We can live with it if we have to."
"We are getting close to the northern edge of Cthul Murgos," Silk said, pointing ahead at a low range of hills. "We won't be able to stop like this once we cross the border. We will have to ride as hard as we can until we can get to the south caravan route. The Murgos patrol extensively, and they disapprove of side trips. Once we get to the track, we'll be all right. But we don't want to be stopped before we get there.
Will we not be questioned, even on the caravan route, Prince Keldar? Our company is oddly assorted, and Murgos are suspicious.
Oh, they'll watch us, Soak admitted. But they won't interfere, as long as we don't stray from the track. The treaty between Tar-Ogos and Ranborun guarantees freedom of travel along the caravan route, and no Murgo alive would be foolish enough to embarrass his king by violating it. Tar-Ogos is very severe with people who embarrass him. They crossed into Chtal Murgos shortly after noon on a cold, murky day, and immediately pushed into a gallop. After about a league or so, Relg began to pull in his horse.
"Not now, Relg," Belgareth told him sharply. "Later." "But Ul is a patient god. He will wait. Keep going."
They galloped on across the high, barren plains toward the caravan route, their cloaks streaming behind them in the biting wind. It was mid-afternoon when they reached the track and reined in. The south caravan route was not precisely a road, but centuries of travel had clearly marked its course. Silk looked around with satisfaction.
"Made it," he said. "Now we become honest merchants again, and no Murgo in the world is going to interfere with us."
He turned his horse eastward then, and led the way with a great show of confidence. He squared his shoulders, seeming to puff himself up with a kind of busy self-importance, and Geryon knew that he was making mental preparations involved in assuming a new role. When they entered the well-guarded pack train of a Tolnedran merchant moving west, Silk had made his transition, and he greeted the merchant with the easy camaraderie of a man of trade.
"Good day, Grand High Merchant," he said to the Tolnedran, noting the other's mark of rank. "If you can spare a moment, I thought we might exchange information about the trail. You have come from the east, and I've just come over the route to the west of here. An exchange might prove mutually beneficial."
"It is an excellent idea," the Tolnedran agreed. The Grand High Merchant was a stocky man with a high forehead, and wore a fur-lined cloak pulled tightly about him to ward off the icy wind.
"My name is Ambar," Silk said, "from Koto."
The Tolnedran nodded in polite acknowledgment.
"Kalvor," he introduced himself, "of Tolhob." "You have picked a hard season for that journey east, Ambar."
"A necessity," Silk told him. "My funds are limited, and the cost of winter lodgings in Tolhonath would have devoured what little I have."
"The Hunnos are rapacious," Kalvor concurred. "Is Ranborun still alive?"
"He was when I left," Kalvor made a face.
"And the squabble over the secession goes on?"
Silk laughed.
"Oh, yes. Is that swine Kador from Tol Vordu still dominant?"
"Kador fell upon hard times, I understand. I heard that he made an attempt on the life of Princess Zenedra. I imagine that the Emperor is going to take steps to remove him from the race."
"What splendid news," Kalvor said, his face brightened.
"And how is the trail to the east?" Silk asked.
"There is not much now," Kalvor told him. "Of course there never is in Chtal Murgos. It's a very dry kingdom. It is cold, though. It is bare in the passes. What about the mountains in eastern Tolnedra?"
"It was snowing when we came through."
"I was afraid of that," Kalvor said with a gloomy look.
"You probably should have waited till spring, Kalvor. The worst part of the trip is still ahead of you."
"I had to get out of Rakoska."
Kalvor looked around, almost as if expecting to see someone listening.
"You're headed toward trouble, Ambar," he said seriously.
"Oh?" This is not the time to go to Ragoska. The Murgos have gone insane there.
Insane? Silk said with alarm.
There is no other explanation. They're arresting honest merchants on the flimsiest charges you ever heard of, and everyone from the West is followed constantly. It's certainly not the time to take a lady to that place.
My sister, Silk replied, glancing at Aunt Paul. She's invested in my venture. But she does not trust me. She insisted on coming along to make sure that I don't cheat her.
I'd stay out of Ragoska, Kalvor advised.
Ah, but I am committed now, Silk said helplessly. I don't have any other choice, do I?
I'll tell you quite honestly, Ambar. It's as much as a man's life is worth to go to Ragoska just now. A good merchant I know was actually accused of violating the women's quarters in a Murgo household.
Well, I suppose that happens sometimes. Murgo women are reputed to be very handsome.
Ambar, Calvor said with a pained expression. The man was 73 years old.
His sons can be proud of his vitality, then, Silk laughed. What happened to him?
He was condemned and impaled, Calvor said with a shudder. The soldiers rounded us all up and made us watch. It was ghastly, Silk frowned.
There's no chance that the charges were true.
73 years old, Ambar, Calvor repeated. The charges are obviously false. If I didn't know better, I guess that Tar Ugas is trying to drive all Western merchants out of Kral Murgos. Ragoska simply isn't safe for us anymore.
Silk grimaced. Who can ever say what Tar Ugas is thinking?
He profits from every transaction in Ragoska. He would have to be insane to drive us all out deliberately.
I have met Tar Ugas, Silk said grimly. Sanity is not one of his major failings.
He looked around with a kind of desperation on his face.
Calvor, I have invested everything I own, and everything I can borrow in this venture. If I turn back now, I'll be ruined.
You could turn north after you get through the mountains, Calvor suggested. Cross the river into Mishrekak Tul and go to Tul Mardu.
Silk made a face. I hate dealing with tolls.
There's another possibility, the Tolnedrin said. You know where the halfway point between Tolhonath and Ragoska is?
Silk nodded.
There's always been a Murgo resupply station there. Food, spare horses, other necessities. Anyway, since the troubles in Ragoska, a few enterprising Murgos have come out there and are buying a whole caravan, loads of it, horses and all. Their prices aren't as attractive as the prices in Ragoska, but it's a chance for some profit, and you don't have to put yourself in danger to make it.
But that way, you have no goods for the return journey, Silk objected. Half the profit is lost if you come back with nothing to sell in Tolhonath.
You'd have your life, Ambar, Calvor said pointedly.
He looked around again nervously, as if expecting to be arrested.
I'm not coming back to Tol Murgos, he declared in a firm voice. I'm as willing as any man to take the risks for a good profit. But all the gold in the world is not worth another trip to Ragoska.
How far is it to the halfway point? Silk asked, seemingly troubled.
We've ridden for 3 days since I left there, Calvor replied. Good luck to you, Ambar. Whatever you decide.
He gathered up his reins.
I want to put a few more leagues behind me. Oh, before I stop for the night, there may be snow in the Tol Nedran Mountains, but at least I'll be out of Khalmurgos and out from under the fist of Taurugas.
He nodded briefly and moved off to the west at a fast trot, with his guards and his pack train following after him. Chapter 21 The south caravan route wound through a series of high, arid valleys that ran in a generally east-west direction. The surrounding peaks were high, higher, probably, than the mountains to the west, but their upper slopes were only faintly touched with snow. The clouds overhead turned the sky a dirty slate gray, but what moisture they held did not fall on this desiccated wilderness of sand, rock, and scrubby thorn. Though it did not snow, it was nonetheless bitterly cold. The wind blew continually, and its edge was like a knife. They rode east, making good time.
"Bogorath," Barak said back over his shoulder. "There's a Murgo on that ridgeline ahead, just to the south of the track. I see him. What's he doing, watching us? He won't do anything as long as we stay on the caravan route."
"They always watch like that," Silk stated. "The Murgos like to keep a close watch on everybody in their kingdom."
"The Tol Nedran, Kalvor," Barak said. "Do you think he was exaggerating?"
"No," Belgarath replied. "I'd guess that Taurugas is looking for an excuse to close the caravan route and expel all of the westerners from Khalmurgos."
"Why's that?" Durnik asked.
Belgarath shrugged.
"The war is coming. Taurugas knows that a good number of the merchants who take this route to Rokgoska are spies. He'll be bringing armies up from the south soon, and he'd like to keep their numbers and movements a secret. What manner of army could be gathered from so bleak and uninhabited a realm?" Mandarallan asked.
Belgarath looked around at the high, bleak desert.
"This is only the little piece of Khalmurgos that we are permitted to see. It stretches 1,000 leagues or more to the south, and there are cities down there that no westerner has ever seen. We do not even know their names. Here in the north, the Murgos play a very elaborate game to conceal the real Khalmurgos."
"Is that thy thought, then, that the war will come soon?"
"Next summer, perhaps. Possibly the summer following."
"Are we going to be ready?"
"We're going to try to be."
Aunt Paul made a brief sound of disgust.
"What's wrong?"
Garion asked her quickly.
"Vultures. Filthy brutes," she said.
A dozen heavy-bodied birds were flapping and squawking over something on the ground to one side of the caravan track.
"Now what are they feeding on?" Durnik asked. "I haven't seen any animals of any kind since we left the top of the escarpment."
"A horse, probably. Or a man," Silk said. "There is nothing else up here."
"Would a man be left unburied?"
"Only partially," Silk told him. "Sometimes certain brigands decide that the pickings along the caravan route might be easy. The Murgos give them plenty of time to realize how wrong they were."
Durnik looked at him questioningly.
"The Murgos catch them," Silk explained, "and then they bury them up to the neck and leave them. The vultures have learned that a man in that situation is helpless. Often they get impatient and don't bother to wait for the man to finish dying before they start to eat."
"That's one way to deal with the bandits," Barak said, almost approvingly. "Even a Murgo can have a good idea once in a while."
"Unfortunately, Murgos automatically assume that anyone who is not on the track itself is a bandit."
The vultures brazenly continued to feed, refusing to leave their dreadful feast as the party passed no more than 20 yards from their flapping congregation. Their wings and bodies concealed whatever it was that they were feeding on, a fact for which Garion was profoundly grateful. Whatever it was, however, was not very large.
We should stay quite close to the track when we stop for the night, then,
Durnick said, averting his eyes with a shudder.
That's a very good idea, Durnick,
Silk agreed. The information the Tolnedran merchant had given them about the makeshift fair at the halfway point proved to be accurate. On the afternoon of the third day, they came over a rise and saw a cluster of tents surrounding a solid stone building set to one side of the caravan track. The tents looked small in the distance, and they billowed and flapped in the endless wind that swept down the valley.
"What do you think?" Silk asked Belgarath.
"It is late," the old man replied. "We are going to have to stop for the night soon anyway. And it would look peculiar if we did not stop."
Silk nodded.
"We are going to have to try to keep Relg out of sight, though. No one's going to believe that we are ordinary merchants if they see an Ulgo with us."
Silk thought a moment.
"We'll wrap him in a blanket and tell anybody who asks that he is sick. People stay away from sick men."
Belgarath nodded.
"Can you act sick?"
he asked Relg.
"I am sick,"
the Ulgo said, without any attempt at humor.
"Is it always this cold up here?"
He sneezed then. Aunt Paul pulled her horse over beside his and reached out to put her hand on his forehead.
"Don't touch me!"
Relg cringed away from her hand.
"Oh, stop that," she told him.
She briefly touched his face and looked at him closely.
"He's coming down with a cold, Father. As soon as we get settled, I'll give him something for it. Why didn't you tell me?"
she asked the fanatic.
"I will endure what Ul chooses to send me," Ralg declared. "It is his punishment for my sins."
"No, it has nothing to do with sin or punishment. It is a cold, nothing more."
"Am I going to die?"
Ralg asked.
"Oh, of course not. Haven't you had a cold before?"
"No. I have never been sick in my life."
"Oh, you won't be able to say that again," Silk said lightly, pulling a blanket out of one of the packs and handing it over to him.
"Wrap this around your shoulders and pull it up over your head. Try to look like you're suffering."
"I am,"
Relg said, starting to cough.
"But you have to look like it," Silk told him. "Think about sin. That ought to make you look miserable."
"I think about sin all the time," Relg replied, still coughing.
"Oh, I know," Silk said. "But try to think about it a little harder."
They rode down the hill toward the collection of tents with the dry, icy wind whipping at them as they rode. Very few of the assembled merchants were outside their tents, and those who were moved quickly about their tasks in the biting chill.
"We should stop by the resupply station first, I suppose,"
Silk suggested, gesturing toward the square stone building squatting among the tents.
"That would look more natural. Let me handle things."
"Silk, you mangy Thrasnian thief!"
a coarse voice roared from a nearby tent. Silk's eyes widened slightly, and then he grinned.
"I seem to recognize the squeals of a certain Nadrek hog."
He said it loud enough to be heard by the man in the tent. A rangy Nadrek, in a belted ankle-length black felt overcoat and a snug-fitting fur cap, strode out of the tent. He had coarse black hair and a thin, scraggly beard. But unlike the dead eyes of the Murgos, this Nadrak's eyes were alive with a kind of wary friendship.
"Haven't they caught you yet, Silk?"
he demanded raucously.
"I was sure that by now someone would have peeled off your hide."
"Drunk, as usual, I see,"
Silk grinned viciously.
"How many days has it been this time, Yarblek?"
"Who counts?"
the Nadrek laughed, swaying slightly on his feet.
"What are you doing in Ktholmurgos, Silk? I thought your fat king needed you in Garog Nadrach.
I was getting to be a little too well known on the streets of Yar Nadrach, Sok replied. It was getting to the point that people were avoiding me.
Now, I wonder just why that would be,
Yarblek retorted with heavy sarcasm.
You cheat at trade. You switch dice. You make free with other men's wives, and you are a spy. I shouldn't be any reason for men not to admire your good points. You know, whatever they are.
Your sense of humor is as overpowering as ever, Yarblek.
It's my only failing,
the slightly tipsy Nadrach admitted.
Get down off that horse, Silk. Come inside my tent, and we'll get drunk together. You know, bring your friends.
He lurched back inside the tent. An old acquaintance, Silk explained quickly, sliding out of his saddle.
Can he be trusted? Barak asked suspiciously.
Not entirely, but he's all right. He's not a bad fellow, really, for a Nadrach. He will know everything that's going on, and if he's drunk enough, we might be able to get some useful information out of him.
Get in here, Silk!
Yarblek roared from inside his gray felt tent.
Let's see what he has to say,
Belgarath said. They all dismounted, tied up their horses to a picket line at the side of the Nadrach tent, and then trooped inside. The tent was large, and the floor and walls were covered with thick crimson carpets. An oil lamp hung from the ridgepole, and an iron brazier shimmered out waves of heat. Yarblek was sitting cross-legged on the carpeting at the back of the tent, with a large black keg conveniently beside him.
"Come in, come in," he said brusquely. "Close the flap. You're letting out all of the heat."
"This is Yarblek," Silk said by way of introduction. "An adequate merchant, and a notorious drunkard. We have known each other for a very long time now."
"My tent is yours,"
Yarblek hiccuped indifferently.
"It's not much of a tent, but it's yours anyway. There are cups over there, that pile of things by my saddle. Some of them are even clean. Let's all have a drink."
"This is Mistress Paul Yarblek," Silk introduced her.
"Good-looking woman,"
Yarblek observed, looking at her boldly.
"Forgive me for not getting up, mistress, but I feel a bit giddy at the moment. Probably something I ate."
"Of course," she agreed, with a dry little smile. "A man should always be careful about what he puts in his stomach."
"I have made that exact point myself 1,000 times.
He squinted at her as she pulled back her hood and unfastened her cape.
"That's a remarkably handsome woman, Silk," he declared. "I don't suppose that you care to sell her."
"You could not afford me, Yarblek," she told him, without seeming to take the slightest offense. Yarblek stared at her, and then roared with laughter.
"By one eye's nose, I bet that I couldn't at that. And you've probably got a dagger somewhere under your clothes, too. You'd slice open my belly if I tried to steal you, wouldn't you?"
"Naturally."
"What a woman!" Yarblek chortled. "Can you dance, too?"
"Like you have never seen before, Yarblek," she replied. "I could turn your bones to water." Yarblek's eyes burned.
"After we all get drunk, maybe you'll dance for us."
"We'll see," she said with a hint of promise. Geryon was stunned at this uncharacteristic boldness. It was obviously the way Yarblek expected a woman to behave. But Geryon wondered just when Aunt Paul had learned the customs of the Nadrach so well that she could respond without the slightest hint of embarrassment.
"This is Mr. Wolf," Silk said, indicating Belgarath.
Never mind names.
Yarblick waved his hand.
I just forget them anyway.
He did, however, look rather shrewdly at each of them.
As a matter of fact,
he continued, sounding suddenly not nearly as drunk as he appeared,
it might be just as well if I didn't know your names. What a man doesn't know, he cannot reveal, and you are too well mixed a group to be in stinking Tholmurgos on honest business. Fetch yourselves, cups. This keg is almost full, and I've got another chilling out back of the tent.
At Silk's gesture, they each took a cup from the heap of cookware piled beside a well-worn saddle, and joined Yarblick on the carpet near the keg.
I would pour for you like a proper host, Yarblick told them. But I spill too much that way. Dip out your own.
Yarblick's ale was a very dark brown, and had a rich, almost fruity flavor.
Interesting taste, Barak said politely.
My brewer chops dried apples into his vats, the Nadrek replied. It smooths out some of the bite.
He turned to Silk.
I thought you didn't like Murgos.
I don't.
What are you doing in Tholmurgos, then?
Silk shrugged. Business.
Whose? Yours or Rodar's?
Silk winked at him.
I thought as much. I wish you luck, then. I'd even offer to help. But I'd probably better keep my nose out of it. Murgos distrust us even more than they distrust you, Alarms. Not that I really blame them. Any Nadrok worth the name would go 10 leagues out of his way for the chance to cut a Murgos throat.
Your affection for your cousins touches my heart, Silk grinned. Yarblick scowled.
Cousins, he spat. If it weren't for the Grolems, we would have exterminated this whole cold-blooded race generations ago.
He dipped out another cup of ale, lifted it, and said,
Confusion to the Murgos.
We think that we have found something we can drink to together, Barak said with a broad smile. Confusion to the Murgos.
And may Tarugas grow boils on his behind,
Yarblick added. He drank deeply, scooped another cup full of ale from the open keg, and drank again.
I'm a little bit drunk, he admitted.
We would have never guessed, Aunt Paul told him.
I like you, girl,
Yarblick grinned at her.
I wish I could afford to buy you. I don't suppose you would consider running away?
She sighed a mocking little sigh.
No,
she refused.
I'm afraid not. That gives a woman a bad reputation, you know.
Very true,
Yarblick agreed owlishly. He shook his head sadly.
As I was saying, he went on, I am a little bit drunk. I probably shouldn't say anything about this, but it's not a good time for Westerners to be in Tholmurgos, Alorns particularly. I have been hearing some strange things lately. Word has been filtering out of Rakthol that Murgoland is to be purged of outsiders. Tarugas wears the crown and plays king in Rakgoska. But the old Grolem at Rakthol has his hand around Tarugas' heart. The king of the Murgos knows that one squeeze from Tuchuk will leave his throne empty.
We met a Tonedrin, a few leagues west of here, who said the same sort of thing, Silk said seriously. He told us that merchants from the west were being arrested all over Rakoska on false charges.
Yarblick nodded.
That's only the first step. Murgos are always predictable. They have so little imagination. Tarugas isn't quite ready to offend Ranbarun openly, by butchering every western merchant in the kingdom. But it's getting closer. Rakoska's probably a closed city by now. Tarugas is free to turn his attention to the outlands. I'd imagine that's why he's coming here.
He's what?
Silk's face paled visibly.
I thought you knew, Yarblek told him. Tarugas is marching toward the frontier, with his army behind him. My guess is he plans to close the border.
How far away is he?
I was told that he was seen this morning not 5 leagues from here. What's wrong?
Tarugas and I have had some serious fallings out, Silk answered quickly, his face filled with consternation. I cannot be here when he arrives. He jumped to his feet.
Where are you going?
Belgareth asked quickly.
Someplace safe. I will catch up with you later.
He turned then and bolted out of the tent. A moment later they heard the pounding of his horse's hooves.
Do you want me to go with him?
Barak asked Belgareth.
You would never catch him. I wonder what he did to Tarugas,
Yarblek mused. He chuckled then.
It must have been something pretty awful, the way the little thief ran out of here.
Is it safe for him to go away from the caravan track?
Garion asked it, remembering the vultures at their grisly feast beside the trail.
Don't worry about Silk, Yarblek replied confidently.
From a great distance away, a slow thudding sound began to intrude itself. Yarblek's eyes narrowed with hate.
Yeah, looks like Silk left just in time.
The thudding became louder and turned into a hollow booming sound. Dimly, behind the booming, they could hear a kind of groaning chant of hundreds of voices in a deep, minor key.
Oh, what's that? Dernick asked. Tarugas,
Yarblek answered, then spat.
That's the war song of the King of the Murgos.
Whore?
Mandarallan demanded sharply.
Now, Tarugas is always at war,
Yarblek replied with heavy contempt.
Even when there is not anybody to be at war with, he sleeps in his armor, even in his own palace. It makes him smelly. But all Murgos stink anyway, so it doesn't really make any difference. Maybe I'd better go see what he's up to.
He got heavily to his feet.
Wait here, he told them. This is a Nadrak tent, and there are certain courtesies expected between Angoraks. His soldiers won't come in here, so you'll be safe as long as you stay inside.
He lurched toward the door of the tent, an expression of icy hatred on his face. The chanting and the measured drum beats grew louder. Shrill fifes picked up a discordant, almost jigging accompaniment, and then there was a sudden blaring of deep-throated horns.
What do you think, Belgarath? This Yarblek seems like a good enough fellow, but he is still an Angorak. One word from him, and we'll have 100 Murgos in here with us.
He is right, Father,
Aunt Paul agreed.
I know Nadrex well enough to know that Yarblek was not nearly as drunk as he pretended to be.
Belgareth pursed his lips.
Maybe it is not too good an idea to gamble all that much on the fact that the Nadrex despise Murgos. We might be doing Yarblek an injustice, but perhaps it might be better just to slip away before Tarugas has time to put guards around the whole place anyway. There's no way of knowing how long he's going to stay here, and once he settles in, we might have trouble leaving.
Dernick pulled aside the red carpeting that hung along the back wall, reached down and tugged out several tent pegs. He lifted the canvas.
I think we can crawl out here. Let's go, then,
Belgareth decided. One by one, they rolled out of the tent into the chill wind.
get the horses, Belgarath said quietly.
He looked around, his eyes narrowing.
That gully, over there.
He pointed at a wash opening just beyond the last row of tents.
If we keep the tents between us and the main caravan track, we should be able to get into it without being seen. Most likely everybody here is going to be watching the arrival of Chaurugas.
Would the Murgo King know thee, Belgarath?
Mandarallan asked. He might. We have never met. But my description's been noised about in Kral Murgos for a long time now. It is best not to take any chances.
They led their horses along the back of the tents and gained the cover of the gully without incident.
This wash comes down off the back side of that hill there, Beric pointed. If we follow it, we'll be out of sight all the way. And once we get the hill between us and the camp, we'll be able to ride away without being seen.
It is almost evening now.
Belgarath looked up at the lowering sky.
Let's go up a ways and then wait until after dark.
They moved on up the gully until they were behind the shoulder of the hill.
Better keep an eye on things, Belgarath said.
Beric and Geryon scrambled up out of the gully and moved at a crouch to the top of the hill, where they lay down behind a scrubby bush.
Here they come, Beric muttered.
A steady stream of grim-faced Murgo soldiers marched eight abreast into the makeshift fair to the cadenced beat of great drums. In their midst, astride a black horse and under a flapping black banner, rode Chaurugas. He was a tall man with heavy sloping shoulders and an angular, merciless face. The thick links of his mail shirt had been dipped in molten red gold, making it almost appear as if he were covered with blood. A thick metal belt encircled his waist, and the scabbard of the sword he wore on his left hip was jewel-encrusted. A pointed steel helmet sat low over his black eyebrows, and the blood-red crown of Kol Murgos was riveted to it. A kind of chain-mail hood covered the back and sides of the king's neck and spread out over his shoulders. When he reached the open area, directly in front of the square stone supply post, Chaurugas reined in his horse.
"Wine!"
he commanded. His voice, carried by the icy wind, seemed startlingly close. Geryon squirmed a bit lower under the bush. The Murgo who ran the supply post scurried inside and came back out, carrying a flagon and a metal goblet. Chaurugas took the goblet, drank, and then slowly closed his big fist around it, crushing it in his grip. Barak snorted with contempt.
"What was that about?"
Geryon whispered.
"Nobody drinks from a cup once Chaurugas has used it," the red-bearded Kerik replied. "If Anheg behaved like that, his warriors would dunk him in the bay at Val'Alon."
"Have you the names of all foreigners here?"
the king demanded of the Murgo storekeeper, his wind-carried voice distinct in Geryon's ears.
"As you commanded, dear king,"
the storekeeper replied, with an obsequious bow. He drew a roll of parchment out of one sleeve and handed it up to his ruler. Chaurugas unrolled the parchment and glanced at it.
"Summon the Nadrak Yarblek. Let Yarblek of Garag Nadrak approach,"
an officer at the king's side bellowed. Yarblek, his felt overcoat flapping stiffly in the wind, stepped forward.
"Our cousin from the north,"
Chaurugas greeted him coldly.
"Your majesty,"
Yarblek replied with a slight bow.
"It would be well if you departed, Yarblek,"
the king told him.
"My soldiers have certain orders, and some of them fail to recognize a fellow Angorak in their eagerness to obey my commands. I cannot guarantee your safety if you remain. And I would be melancholy if something unpleasant befell you."
Yarblek bowed again.
"My servants and I will leave at once, your majesty."
"If they are Nadraks, they have our permission to go. All foreigners, however, must remain. You are dismissed, Yarblek."
"I think we got out of that tent just in time,"
Barak muttered. Then a man in a rusty mail shirt covered with a greasy brown vest stepped out of the supply post. He was unshaven, and the white of one of his eyes gleamed unwholesomely.
Brill!
Garion exclaimed. Barak's eyes went flat. Brill bowed to Taurogos with an unexpected grace.
Hail, mighty king, he said.
His tone was neutral, carrying neither respect nor fear.
What are you doing here, Kordach?
Taurogos demanded coldly.
I am on my master's business, dread king, Brill replied.
What business would Tuchik have in a place like this? Something personal, great king,
Brill answered evasively.
I like to keep track of you, and the other Dagashi, Kordach. When did you come back to Thormogos?
A few months ago,
mighty arm of Tarak. If I had known you were interested, I would have sent word to you. The people my master wants me to deal with know I'm following them, so my movements aren't secret.
Taurogos laughed shortly, a sound without any warmth in it.
You must be getting old, Kordach. Most Dagashi would have finished the business by now.
These are rather special people, Brill shrugged.
It shouldn't take me much longer, however. The game is nearly over. Incidentally, great king, I have a gift for you.
He snapped his fingers sharply, and two of his henchmen came out of the building, dragging a third man between them. There was blood on the front of the captive's tunic, and his head hung down, as if he were only semi-conscious.
Barak's breath hissed between his teeth.
I thought you might like a bit of sport,
Brill suggested.
I am the king of Thormogos, Kordach,
Taurogos replied coldly.
I am not amused by your attitude. And I am not in the habit of doing chores for the Dagashi. If you want him dead, kill him yourself.
This would hardly be a chore, Your Majesty, Brill said with an evil grin.
The man's an old friend of yours.
He reached out roughly, grasping the prisoner's hair and jerking his head up for the king to see his face. It was Silk. His face was pale, and a deep cut on one side of his forehead trickled blood down the side of his face.
Behold, the Trasnian spy, Keldar,
Brill smirked.
I make a gift of him to your majesty.
Taurogos began to smile then, his eyes lighting with a dreadful pleasure.
Splendid. You have the gratitude of your king, Kordach. Your gift is beyond price.
His smile grew broader.
Greetings, Prince Keldar,
he said, almost purring.
I have been waiting for the chance to see you again for a long time now. We have many old scores to settle, don't we?
Silk seemed to stare back at the Murgle King, but Garion could not be sure if he were conscious enough even to comprehend what was happening to him.
Abide here a bit, Prince of Dresnia,
Taurogos gloated.
I will want to give some special thought to your final entertainment. And I will want to be sure that you are fully awake to appreciate it. You deserve something exquisite, I think. Probably lingering. And I certainly would not want to disappoint you by rushing into it.
Chapter 22. Barak and Garion slid back down into the gully, with the gravel rattling down the steep bank around them.
They have got Silk, Barak reported quietly. Brill is there. It looks as if he and his men caught Silk while he was trying to leave. They've turned him over to Tal'Rogas.
Belgareth stood up slowly, a sick look on his face.
Is he?
He broke off.
No, Barak answered. He's still alive. It looks as if they roughed him up a little, but he seemed to be all right.
Belgareth let out a long, slow breath.
Yeah, that's something, anyway. Tal'Rogas seemed to know him, Barak continued. It sounded as if Silk had done something that offended the king pretty seriously. And Tal'Rogas looks like the kind of a man who holds grudges.
Are they holding him someplace where we can get to him?
Durnick asked.
We couldn't tell,
Geryon answered.
They all talked for a while, and then several soldiers took him around behind that building down there. We couldn't see where they took him.
The Murgle who runs the place said something about a pit.
We have to do something, Father.
I know, Paul, I know. We'll come up with something.
He turned toward Barak again.
How many soldiers did Tal'Rogas bring with him?
A couple of regiments, at least. They're all over the place down there.
We could translocate him, Father,
Aunt Paul suggested.
That's a long way to lift something, Paul. Besides, we'd have to know exactly where he's been being held.
I'll find that out. She reached up to unfasten her cloak.
You'd better wait until after dark, he told her. There are not many owls in Skolmogos, and you would attract attention in the daylight. Did Tal'Rogas have any Grolems with him?
He asked Geryon.
I think I saw a couple.
Yeah, that's going to complicate things. Translocation makes an awful noise. We'll have Tal'Rogas right on our heels when we leave.
Do you have any other ideas, Father?
Oh, let me work on it. At any rate, we can't do anything until it gets dark.
A low whistle came from some distance down the gully.
Who's that?
Barak's hand went to his sword.
Ho! Elons!
It was a hoarse whisper.
Methinks it is the Nadrak Yarblek, Mandarallan said. How did he know we were here? Barak demanded.
There was the crunching sound of footsteps in the gravel, and Yarblek came around a bend in the gully. His fur cap was low over his face, and the collar of his felt overcoat was pulled up around his ears.
There you are,
he said, sounding relieved.
Are you alone?
Barak's voice was heavy with suspicion.
Of course I'm alone,
Yarblek snorted.
I told my servants to go on ahead. You certainly left in a hurry.
We didn't feel like staying to greet Tal'Rogas, Barak replied.
It's probably just as well. I'd have had a great deal of trouble getting you out of that mess back there. The Murgle soldiers inspected every one of my people to be sure they were all Nadrak before they had let me leave. Tal'Rogas has Silk.
We know. How did you find us?
You left the pegs pulled up at the back of my tent. And this hill is the closest cover on this side of the fair. I guessed which way you would go, and you left a track here and there to confirm it.
The Nedrak's coarse face was serious, and he showed no signs of his extended bout at the ale barrel.
We're going to have to get out of here. Tal'Rogas will be putting out patrols soon, and you are almost in his lap. We must rescue our companion first,
Mandarallan told him.
Silk? You had better forget that. I'm afraid my old friend has switched his last pair of dice. I liked him, too.
Well, he's not dead yet, is he? Durnick's voice was almost sick.
No, not yet. Well, Tal'Rogas plans to correct that when the sun comes up in the morning. I could not even get close enough to the pit to drop a dagger to him so he could open a vein. I am afraid his last morning is going to be a bad one.
Why are you trying to help us? Barak asked bluntly.
You will have to excuse him, Yarblek.
He is not familiar with Nadrak custom. She turned to Barak. He invited you into his tent and offered you his ale. That makes you the same as his brother until sunrise tomorrow.
Yarblek smiled briefly at her.
You seem to know us quite well, girl. I never got to see you dance, did I?
Perhaps another time.
Perhaps so.
He squatted and pulled a curved dagger from beneath his overcoat.
He smoothed the patch of sand with his other hand and began sketching rapidly with his dagger point.
The Murgos are going to watch me, so I can't add half a dozen or so more people to my party without having them all over me. I think the best thing would be for you to wait here until dark. I will move out to the east and stop a league or so on the caravan track. As soon as it gets dark, you can step around and catch up with me. We'll work something out after that.
Why did Taurugas tell you to leave?
Yarblek looked grim.
There's going to be a large accident tomorrow. Taurugas will immediately send an apology to Ran Borun. Something about inexperienced troops chasing a band of brigands and mistaking honest merchants for bandits. He will offer to pay a reparation, and things will be all smoothed over. Pay is a magic word when you are dealing with the Tonedrans.
He's going to massacre this whole camp?
Barak sounded stunned.
That is his plan. He wants to clean all of the Westerners out of Skol Murgos, and he seems to think that a few accidents will do the job for him.
Relg had been standing to one side, his large eyes lost in thought. Suddenly he stepped across the gully to where Yarblek's sketch was. He smoothed it out of the sand.
Can you show me exactly where this pit in which they are holding our friend is located? It won't do you any good. It is guarded by a dozen men. Silka's got quite a reputation. And Taurugas does not want him to get away.
Just show me, Relg insisted.
Yarblek shrugged.
We are here on the north side. He roughed in the fair and the caravan route. The supply station is here.
He pointed with his dagger.
The pit is just beyond it at the base of that big hill on the south side. What kind of walls does it have? Solid stone. Is it a natural fissure in the rock, or has it been dug out? What difference can it make? I need to know. I didn't see any tool marks, and the opening at the top is irregular. It is probably just a natural hole.
Relg nodded.
And the hill behind it? Is it rock or dirt?
Mostly rock. All of stinking Tol Murgos is mostly rock.
Relg stood up.
Thank you, he said politely.